It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, corporations these days seem to be speaking out on political and social issues more and more often. We'll find out what's behind the current wave of corporate activism. First, if you were to dump out all the contents of your home, how many things would you have if you had to guess? There's no judgment here. Our producer, J. Carlisle Larson, stopped counting after she reached 100 things around her desk alone. According to some statistics, the average American home has some 300,000 objects within its walls. As people, we have a messy and complex relationship to stuff, whether it's clothing or books or toys and trinkets. These objects can sometimes hold an incredible sentimental value, and stuff can inspire a whole range of feelings. Case in point. I know you're gone, and it's just a pivot out of sight. It's out of mind, and I'm not ready to say goodbye. 'Cause when it's love, it's not just stuff. Song literally called Stuff by singer Kaylee Rose. It outlines how difficult it can be to get rid of things, in this case, after a breakup. Our next guest is here to talk about our emotional attachment to items and why we're primed to want to buy and hold on to stuff. Regan Gurung is professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay and Oregon State University. Regan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
So psychologically, Regan, what makes us want stuff?
I think you can break it down and look at it from a couple of different levels. At the most basic level, I think stuff makes us feel good. It feels good to buy stuff, and often I don't think we can help it. We are living in a world that's engineered to make us want stuff. You turn on the TV, you look at social media, there, you know, you have various people showing their stuff, and it's hard to not want stuff once you see stuff. So I think, you know, it's really the feel good is at the heart of it, but I also think there's a very large component of us not being able to really help ourselves. And I know this varies a lot from person to person, but for many of us, there are certain things that we just can't help going out and buying.
I've seen some happiness studies suggest that we think a thing we buy is going to make us happier than it really does. There's an initial burst of happiness, but it fades pretty quick. Do you see that?
Well, absolutely. And that's something called habituation. I think we very often habituate to something that we have, and something brand new, whether it's a brand new pen that flows really well or a new piece of clothing or something like that may make us feel really good, and we may like looking at it. But over time, we get used to it. And as we get used to it, it doesn't have that same appeal anymore. I also think combined with exactly what you said and in those happiness studies, very often, especially if we want happiness, we're always looking for that silver bullet that we believe can give it to us. And if something doesn't work, we try and reach out for something else. And so we move on to something else. And very often, those some things that we try may work in the short term, but may not work in the long run, and we need to turn to something else.
And I don't want to overplay a drug addiction here, but do we need to escalate if buying that, I don't know, $5 item doesn't work the third time? Maybe we go for a bigger, more expensive thing that we think is going to make us happier.
Well, it's interesting that you say overplay the drug relationship, but I think at the most basic level, when we talk about pleasure, we're often talking about a chemical reaction in our brains. In this case, buying stuff is probably the easiest way for us to self-medicate in many ways. And you've probably heard of the chemical dopamine. And dopamine in general is regarded as the pleasure chemical. There are many things that we do that feel good. And almost always when you report or can say, oh boy, this feels good, it's accompanied by the surge in dopamine. So in some ways, that surge of dopamine, I mean, there is this drug making us feel good. And when we habituate to something, that something may not give us that same level of dopamine. So we do it a little bit more. And I think that often relates to buying things where, you know, maybe some of us need to buy things more often to get that shot of dopamine in our system.
Talking to psychology professor Regan Gurung about things and stuff, the things we buy, the things we keep, whether or not they make us happy in the short and or long run. Regan, we've heard the phrase self-care out there a lot lately. The idea being, hey, if you're feeling stressed in life, take some time to take care of yourself. Pretty good idea, I think. Right. But it seems like that's been captured by marketers and social media to have self-care equal pay money for a thing. Do you see that?
Right. And actually, there's an entire area of consumer psychology that looks at something called retail therapy. And, you know, you've heard the phrase, and there's actually psychological research done on what's referred to as retail therapy. And what it shows is that a significant percent of people, when asked, do you buy things to feel better? I've seen studies showing up to 65 to 70% of people saying, yes, I actually buy things to feel better. And I think there's the classic case of, I want to feel good. Well, let's go out and buy something and maybe that will help me feel better.
That's buying stuff so far. Let's talk about keeping stuff. And let's first key in on the sentimental value of some things. When do we start to imbue an item with an emotional connection for ourselves or maybe to someone else?
I think most often it's when that item is linked to an event or a person. So very often we link events or people to, you know, to music and very often items. So, for example, if you go to the Bay Beach Amusement Park in Green Bay and you buy this little souvenir and you were there with your best friends, every time you look at that souvenir, it's going to be associated with those memories of being with those best friends. And I think a lot of the things, as I look around my office or as I look around the house, very often there are things that we can remember when we got it and with whom we were when we got it. And it's those memories that make items something that we don't want to get rid of. Even when there's clutter, and you mentioned clutter in the opening, you know, the 100-plus items, well, a good chunk of them will have some meaning. And it's very hard to get rid of things that we have tied or tagged meaning to.
We see at the worst level people worried about hoarding, people storing too much stuff, even getting storage spaces. Even on a lesser level, even if we don't go that far, I'll say I keep a lot of stuff I don't need. I think my attitude is something like, well, maybe that random cord from an appliance 20 years ago will be useful someday. How come we want to keep stuff even if it doesn't have that sentimental or useful value?
Well, you know, I think here's the thing. I will bet that those things that you've kept for some day, even if there are 20 of those things that, you know, and you've never touched 18 of those things, two of those things you may have actually found a use for, and it reinforces your whole keeping it. And you go, see, I know, I knew I should have kept it. And I think that's very often when we talk about, when you use the word hoarding, there's also a psychology of hoarding, and that's a whole separate ball of wax where, you know, this may be control, it may be, you know, something more than just the I like how it looks or I like using it often. But most commonly, when we keep things, it's either its associations with positive things, or when it reminds us of good things, or this thought that we have that you nicely captured that we may actually need it at some point, so why get rid of it? Something that's much easier to do when you live in the same house or the same place for a long time. It's very easy to accumulate things and then put them out of sight so you don't have to deal with getting rid of it.
I want to throw one more angle in here as to why we buy and or keep stuff, Regan. The idea that our possessions are a way of self-expression. If I own this shirt, this car, this CD, if we still buy CDs, it says something about who I am.
Right. Well, you know, the fact that you mentioned CDs definitely says something about who you are. But, you know, I think there's associations. I mean, and brand and marketing, brands are... and advertising is geared to make you want a brand because of what it's associated with. So the brand of car that you drive, you know, whether you have an eco-friendly car, for example, again, that says something about you. The clothing that you wear says something about you. And it's very often, as human beings, we automatically decide who somebody is and what they're about based on what they own and the types of things they have. So that's not just this sake, oh, no, that's a superficial kind of thing. I think that's the way we are as human beings, looking for information about what somebody has and what somebody owns to give us a better sense of who they are.
We're talking to Regan Goering right now. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay and Oregon State University. Regan, this Marie Kondo thing, I think is part of why we actually called you up in the first place. It's big. She's got a Netflix show, a book, and a lot of people are picking up one thing at a time saying, does this give me joy? If not, I should get rid of it. What do you think about this apparent trend?
Right. I think that's, you know, in the face of so many of us having so many things, there are many of us who would like to know, well, how can we do something about it? And especially when you take a look at a situation of a house full or an office full of things, where can you even start? Even contemplating trimming and culling what you have is stressful. And so this whole new trend, picking something up, it's a very pragmatic, simple, straightforward approach that seems like it could work. And, I mean, I know there are some of us who will pick up everything we have and go, yep, I do love it, you know. But that said, for the most part, we need to start someplace. And I think that's one very viable way of beginning to say, well, do I really need this? I think, you know, one of the things that are very simple along the same lines, it's also a question of not just looking at what you have, but before you buy something, stopping and going, do I really need this? And, you know, many of us parents use a trick with our kids where if they say they'd like something, I know something I use is say, hey, look, I know you like it. Why don't we wait 1 week? And if you still like it, then maybe we can think about it. And more often than not, a week later, you know, nay, a few days later, it's gone.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Paula with us in Spring Green. Paula, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Paula?
First of all, I am a psychotherapist, so I feel a little guilty even calling in and asking the question. However, I am guilty of having done retail therapy. I don't do as much as I used to because I am retired. I know some of the reasons I've done it in the past because I have felt good. And then I rationalize and justify the items I buy will either be useful, have a utilitarian function, or my daughter or son will want them at some point in their lives. They're adults now. But I am having problems decluttering and letting go, even though I have studied how to let go. Some of the items I've accumulated are works of art, and I find them to be more valuable than what maybe other people might. So that's my question. How do I let go of what I feel is valuable or things my adult children might like?
Paula, thanks a lot for the call. Paula, I'm assuming not alone out there, Regan, in having this kind of quandary.
Yeah, you know, and I think, Paula, you nicely mentioned, you know, a key point here, which is different things have different meanings to different people. And clearly there are some things that have a lot of meaning to you, but I bet there are other things that don't have as much meaning. And I think the question is, if there is something where you feel like there's a lot tied to it, not acting and getting rid of it right away is the key. Something that I've seen often suggested in the research literature is where in an effort to cut down on what you have, you take items, there'll always be things that when you look at it, you go, yep, definitely don't want that. And then there are those things that you're not that sure of. And then there are those things that you know for sure you do like. Well, don't touch that first category. But that middle category of, well, you know, I don't know. Well, keep those someplace separate. Keep those out of sight. Keep those someplace separate. Then go back to it a little later and see how your feelings have changed about it. And very often that taking those out of sight for a while makes you appraise their worth in a slightly different way than you would the very first time you look at it.
Paula, thanks a lot for the call and good luck. We'll go now to Anne with us in Green Bay. Anne, hello.
Hello. Well, the reason I have a hard time eliminating stuff is because I'm a big environmentalist, and if I can't repurpose it, I don't want it to go to a landfill.
Mm-hmm. All right. And does that have you tried to figure out creative ways to reuse stuff, Ann?
I do.
But I guess that has its limits. Regan, yeah, the concerns about what happens to the stuff when it's gone.
You know, I think Wisconsin's a nice place to live in terms of recycling and things like that. And over the last few years, there's been a great increase in venues for recycling and reusing a whole range of things. The big deal, though, and Anne puts her finger on this, is there are still a lot of items that you just can't put by the curbside because they'll be put to the landfill. And one major solution is to actually go to the internet, and you will find, and I found this in terms of things like car seats and things like that, even though there may not be always something available locally, there is something where you can send it to, and you may go, oh, well, I don't want to spend money to send it, but often that price is not that high, and it's a place that will really put that to good use. So that's absolutely a big thing to keep in mind, where you just don't want to ditch all, you know, plastic or things or certain things that aren't going to be picked up. But the good news is there are more and more places, but it does involve a little bit of internet searching.
And thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Regan Gurung, psychology professor, looking at our relationship with the things we buy and own. It sounds like, Regan, maybe the triage should be something more like what you do with your kids. Figure out if we want it in the first place before we buy it, and then have to decide years later whether we want to get rid of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's really, you know, and actually going back to something Paula said, in terms of when you're retired and you have a different cash flow, it may be easier to say, okay, let's watch it, you know, more closely. On the flip side, the more time you have, the more likely you are to go around looking for stuff as well. So, you know, all these different factors can offset or influence your likelihood to buy something. But definitely the more you can put on yourself as that little waiting period, the more you can avoid maybe impulse buys or even mood-related buys. And mood's a big deal when it comes to buying things.
Got an email from Tom in Berlin. Tom says, last year I downsized. It felt so good to toss or sell so much stuff. Now I have, Tom writes, a business cleaning out homes and getting rid of the 300,000 items in each home. It's great exercise, fun, and profitable. Okay, so that's, and I'm guessing some people might have a similar experience where once you get over the hump and start purging some things, you feel like, yeah, it feels pretty good.
Well, and it's not just that, Rob. I think a key point, both in the trend that you mentioned, but also in the business just mentioned, is it's very hard for us to do it ourselves, but it gets a little easier if somebody comes and does it for you. Because, you know, you have somebody come in and say, okay, help me clear this up. We are much more likely to go, okay, I'm all with that. And for many folks, putting ourselves in the hands of our cleaning up company may take a lot of that emotional pressure and that stress off, and maybe the route to go for some of us.
Well, Regan, I want to pose a question that might be personal for you now. Say somebody who's getting ready to move, I don't know, from Wisconsin to Oregon, say, picking a place at random. How do we start to triage what to take with us and what to give up on?
I think moving is probably one of the best times to purge what you have, because there's nothing like a moving company giving you an estimate and going, hey, I don't think I want to take all that. But, you know, earlier on, Rob, you mentioned you've got all this stuff. Well, very often in a house that you've lived in for some time, you don't see all that stuff
yep.
that you have. And any way you can give yourself an opportunity to see all that you have automatically makes you realize how much you do have that you haven't really, that's been hidden away, and right there is a great incentive for cutting down on the stuff that you have and maybe not buying new stuff because you realize you actually have it.
Let's bring on one more caller. Ellen is with us in La Crosse. Ellen, hi.
Hi. I have a property, a cottage that was given to us by my father. And it's got multiple owners. It has some disrepair issues, but we're having a hard time trying to decide if we should get rid of it because of the emotional attachment or tackle repairs that are pretty expensive. And it is really difficult to make the thought of getting rid of the property.
Ellen, I'm guessing there's a lot of memories attached to this place as well, Ellen?
Oh, absolutely. Family memories of 3 generations.
Wow. Ellen, thank you so much for that. That sounds like a difficult situation, Regan, with a lot of memories attached to this very sentimental place for them.
Yeah. And you know, here's one of those situations where getting rid of it, especially with all that emotion attached, is probably one of the last options. And now, you know, entertaining any of the multiple ways to actually keep it in some form or the other, whether it's, you know, by extended family or friends or some way to keep it or even parts of it, that's a much better route to go before considering the getting rid of all those memories.
Ellen, good luck to you and your family members making that decision. And Regan, good luck to you. You are leaving UW-Green Bay, headed on to Oregon State University. I assume we'll still be in touch, though, right?
Absolutely.
Regan, thanks a lot for joining us, and good luck in your next adventure.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
That's Regan Gurung, professor of psychology at UW-Green Bay for now, heading soon to teach at Oregon State University. He joined us today to talk about the complex and sometimes messy relationship we have with the things we buy and keep.